Okay, I want to pick up where we left off in the book of Psalms. We left off in this Psalm 114 is where we left off. And because we're running a little bit late, let's just go ahead and get right into it. It's only 8 verses, but again, you know, it's just packed. I mean, you could really write volumes upon what's being said here. But beginning with verse 1 of Psalm 114, it says, "When Israel went forth from Egypt, the house of Jacob, from the people of a strange language, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion. The sea looked and fled, the Jordan turned back, the mountains skipped like rams, the hills like lambs. What ails you, O sea, that you flee? O Jordan, that you turn back? O mountains, that you skip like rams? O hills, like lambs? Tremble, O earth, before the Lord, before the God of Jacob, who turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of water." Now, like I said, it's only 8 verses, but I'll tell you, you could write volumes upon what's being said here. But just back up and break it down. When it says this, "When Israel went forth from Egypt, the house of Jacob, from a people of strange language, Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion." Now, when it says, when Israel was delivered from the land of Egypt, and they finally got into the promised land, what does this mean when it says Judah became his sanctuary, Israel his dominion? What does that mean?
Jerusalem was in Judah, right?
Yeah, very good. In other words, that's where the temple ended up being set up, was in Judah. And right there, Jerusalem, if you look on a map, you'll find that it's right there on the border between Judah and Benjamin. But Judah and Benjamin, you know, eventually just became the southern tribes when the whole 12 tribes of Israel were split, the northern kingdom and the southern kingdom. But that's what it's talking about here, that Judah became his sanctuary. This is where God, his presence dwelt there in the temple. And anybody recall where he dwelt in the temple? Just back up. Make it to the tabernacle. But the same thing applied to Solomon's temple.
In the innermost.
Yes, in the Holy of Holies. But here's the thing. Just keep this in mind. That in the Holy of Holies, you had that Ark of the Covenant that was just nothing more than a rectangular box. And then it was overlaid with gold. And then it had a lid on the top of the box. And then you had two angels looking down on this lid. The lid called the mercy seat. And they were looking down, and their wings were touching together as they were looking down. All right. Now, inside that ark, inside that box was what? Aaron's rod, the manna, a jar of golden manna, and the Ten Commandments. Now, here's the thing. Where did God dwell?
On top of the mercy seat?
It was above the mercy seat, okay? It was above. His presence dwelt there. Of course, nobody saw him.
Above the angels, too?
Yes, above the angels. He didn't dwell on the ark itself, but above the ark, all right? Now, that's where his presence dwelt, right? That's where he manifested himself, in that Holy of Holies. But it's very important you understand, that's where he chose to be his sanctuary, right there in Jerusalem, in that temple that Solomon built. Well, everything was very, very rich and powerful in terms of its symbolism. Because inside that box, you had the Ten Commandments, Aaron's rod, and a jar of golden manna. But that's where, on top of that box, was that mercy seat that the angels were looking down at. And their wings were touching. If their wings are touching, what does that suggest? They're in agreement. And, you know, everything needs to be established on the basis of 2 or 3 witnesses. And these angels are looking down where? At the mercy seat. What went on that mercy seat?
The blood.
Here's the thing. In that Holy of Holies, the high priest could only go into that Holy of Holies once a year, and that was the Day of Atonement. That was the holiest day of their Jewish calendar, all right? But he actually went in twice that same day. The first thing he did was that they would slaughter a bull, and that bull being slaughtered would be a sin offering on his behalf. All his sins would be forgiven. And then he would take that bucket of blood into the Holy of Holies, and he'd sprinkle it on that mercy seat to forgive him of all his sins, to get right with God. Then he would go out to where the people were, the congregation were, and they'd have 2 goats. And he'd take his hands and lay his hands on one goat and transfer all the sins of the nation onto that goat. And then what they do with the other goat? Yes, the one where all the sins were transferred onto this goat, they let that goat go free. And the innocent goat was the one that was slain. And they took that blood and took it into the Holy of Holies and sprinkled it on the mercy seat. Now, just keep that in mind, because when they sprinkled that blood on there, it was to make atonement for everywhere that men sin against God. In other words, his moral laws, that's the Ten Commandments. Also, you know, the jar of manna, that's where people basically spurn God's provisions or are not grateful for all his blessings. That's a sin. All right, that needs to be covered up with the blood. And then Aaron's rod, representing all the authority that God has placed over us that we defy or rebel against, right? Those are basically the three categories where we offend God. Well, that's what he's talking about here, was that sanctuary. That's where God dwelt, all right? His presence dwelt, and that's where people would go to get right with him and go to worship him and offer sacrifices to him. But then it backs up in that verse 3 of Psalm 114, which says this: the sea looked and fled, the Jordan turned back. Now, what does it mean, the sea looked and fled?
When they crossed the Red Sea?
Yeah, he's talking about what happened at the Red Sea. Remember that situation? I mean, it's in Exodus chapter 14, but it says, "But Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, stand by and see the salvation of the Lord, which he will accomplish for you today. For the Egyptians whom you have seen today, you will never see them again forever. The Lord will fight for you while you keep silent.' Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Why are you crying out to me? Tell the sons of Israel to go forward. As for you, lift up your staff and stretch out your hand over the sea and divide it, and the sons of Israel shall go through the midst of the sea on dry land. As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all of his army, through his chariots and his horsemen.'" And it goes on to say this. He says, "Then the Egyptians will know that I am the Lord when I am honored through Pharaoh, through his chariots and his horsemen." And he goes on to say that then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord swept the sea back by a strong east wind all night and turned the sea to dry land, and the waters were divided, and the sons of Israel went through the midst of the sea on the dry land, and the waters were like a wall to them on their right hand and on their left hand. And the Egyptians took up the pursuit, and all of Pharaoh's horses and his chariots and his horsemen went in after them in the midst of the sea. And then, you know, just concluding this, it says, when he closed over the sea over to Israel's armies, it says, "Thus the Lord saved Israel that day from the hand of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians dead on the seashore. When Israel saw the great power which the Lord had used against the Egyptians, the people feared the Lord, and they believed in Moses and his servants." Now, here's the thing. It's referring back to when God dried up the sea. But it's kind of interesting. Who could tell me? As I deal with this, and people will have a hard time with it, but I've mentioned it many times, that we have to understand when it says here, when God said that, he says, "As for me, behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians so that they will go in after them, and I will be honored through Pharaoh and all his army." Mm-hmm. Now, if you go read the account in regards to the 10 plagues that God sent upon the Egypt, I don't care whether it's the Nile turning to blood, or the frogs, or the gnats, or the flies, or the cattle, or the boils, or the, you know, the hail mixed with fire, and the locusts, and the darkness, 3 days of darkness, and the death of the firstborn. Well, every time that God was about to send a plague, he said, "I will harden Pharaoh's heart." But if you read the context, it says that Pharaoh hardened his heart, including, can you imagine your heart being so hardened that you see the sea split wide open, and then your heart is so hardened that you go in anyway? I mean, anybody with any brains or common sense would have said, "Man, I'm not going in there. I mean, if their God can split that sea open, he can sure bring it down on my head," right? But how do people's hearts become so hardened? Because people will blame God for hardening Pharaoh's heart. But how do people's hearts become hardened?
By not heeding his voice. I mean, the more light hardened. He shines, if they neglect that, or...
Yeah, I think you're hitting around it. All I'm saying is this. I always do is go back to when Jesus Christ raised Lazarus from the dead. All right, that guy had been dead for 4 days. He began to give off an aroma, and, Jesus said, "Well, roll back the stone." And he says, "Lazarus, come forth." He comes forth in his grave clothes, and he says, "Unbound him," or "Unbind him," right? But, interesting thing, it says that many people who witnessed that miracle believed in Jesus Christ. But it says that all the religious leaders that were there that witnessed that, the Pharisees, the scribes, the Sadducees, it says that they said to themselves, "This Jesus Christ is out of control. We've got to kill Jesus Christ. And as a matter of fact, we've got to kill Lazarus and put him back in the grave because he's such a living testimony." Now, You got to ask, how did God harden their heart?
Showed them the truth and hardened
by the light.
You see, here's the thing, that when God shines his light on people, it's either going to be that same, it all depends upon the substance. I mean, the sun will melt wax and harden clay. And a person, when they see the miracles of God, all right, if they do not want to change their life, it's when God shines light on them that they harden their heart. And every time that God hardened Pharaoh's heart, you got to say, well, how did God do that? He did it by shining light on him. In other words, what did Jesus Christ say? He said this, men prefer darkness rather than light. Why?
Deeds are dark.
Because their deeds are evil. Mm-hmm. You see? And so if a person prefers to stay in their sinful state, guess what? When God shines light on them, it hardens their heart. That's the way God hardens their heart. So you can't blame God because all he's doing is shining light on you. You see what I'm saying? So, yeah.
Didn't some of the Pharisees or somebody also attribute Jesus' miracles to Satan?
Yes,
that's
yes.
The ultimate slap in God's face.
Yes, well, you know, they came out and said, well, when Jesus Christ was casting out demons, they said, well, he casts out demons by Beelzebub.
Yeah.
Beelzebub means what?
Lord of the Flies.
Lord of the Flies. You go back to Kings, and Beelzebub was a Philistine god, the god of Ekron, the Philistine god, right? Well, that was the title of Satan, Beelzebub, and Beelzebub basically means Lord of the Flies. And, you know, every time I got to contend with an annoying fly, I can't help but think of demons, you know. And but anyway, it says this. The sea looked and fled, and the Jordan turned back. Now, when it says the Jordan turned back, what is he talking about?
When they walked, put their foot into the Jordan. To Joshua?
Yes.
Yeah, Joshua. They
had to cross over, right?
Cross over, and this Jordan stopped, didn't they?
Yeah. Well, this is what it says in Joshua chapter 3. It says, then Joshua rose early in the morning, and he and all the sons of Israel set out from Shittim and came to the Jordan, and they lodged there before they crossed. At the end of 3 days, the officers went through the midst of the camp, and they commanded the people, saying, when you see the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord your God with the Levitical priest carrying it, then you shall set out from your place and go after it. However, there shall be between you in it a distance of about 2,000 cubits by measure. Do not come near it, that you may know that the way by which you shall go, for you have not passed this way before. Then Joshua said to the people, consecrate yourselves, for tomorrow the Lord will do wonders among you. Then Joshua spoke to the priests, saying, take up the ark of the covenant and cross over the ahead of the people. So they took up the ark of the covenant and went ahead of the people. Now the Lord said to Joshua, this day I will begin to exalt you in the sight of all Israel, that they may know that just as I have been with Moses, I will be with you. You shall moreover command the priests who are carrying the Ark of the Covenant, saying, when you come to the edge of the waters of the Jordan, you shall stand still in the Jordan. Then Joshua said to the sons of Israel, come here and hear the words of the Lord. Now, it goes on to just simply say this. I won't read the whole thing because it's a little too lengthy. But what it's saying is this. God is saying this. All right, when it's time to move out, I want everybody to follow the ark. Now, it's the priests that are carrying the ark. All right, there's four priests. They're from the tribe. They're from the tribe of Levi, obviously, but they're from the clan of the Kohathites. They had the job of transporting the holy articles. But God's presence is now dwelling above this ark, and they got this ark all wrapped up so that nobody can even see it. And the priests are carrying it. Well, it's like they had to carry it, and it had to be. It says here they were 2,000 cubits ahead of everybody else. Yeah. Now, 2,000 cubits is 3,000 feet, right? And so if you've got a situation where a mile is what is a mile is 5,280 feet, well, they have to stay behind this ark over a half a mile back, because nobody can approach God other than the ones who have been selected, and those are the priests. Now, here's the thing. God told these priests, okay, you start marching. And there's the Jordan, and we are told that it's overflowing its banks. It's that time of the year when the Jordan is at its highest, all right? And the priests, they had to walk with faith, and as soon as their feet hit the water receded. And it receded 25 miles up the road at a place called Adam, and that's where that water stood up in a big, huge heap. So these priests had to step out in faith, right? But now, where do those priests end up?
What you mean in the middle?
Yes. In other words, once the priest went through, God told him, okay, you stand here, right in the middle of the Jordan, right there. They had to stand there with God, and then everybody, we're talking maybe 3 to 5 million people now crossed over, while the priest had to stand there, right? Now, if you were one of those priests, what would be going through your mind?
Hurry up.
Yeah, right? You'd be saying to yourself, well, hurry up, you know, because where are these priests standing? They're standing in a place of death. Mm-hmm. You know, because if that water came down, man, they're the first ones to go, right? Now, this is the thing that you have to understand. I don't care where you're a pastor, a minister, a priest, or even like a Bible study teacher. You've got to stand in a place of death if other people are going to cross over into the promised land, into heaven. You mean, you really got to stand firm with God, you know, all along with God, if other people are going to pass over and make it to the promised land. Mm-hmm. See, an interesting thing. God told Joshua to select 12 men, and what they did is they took 12 big stones from the Jordan, from where they were at, where the priests were at, and they took these 12 stones and they took them over to Jordan where they were going to set up a monument, all right? Yeah. But they also took 12 stones and did what with them? They set up a monument in right there where the priests were at, so that when the water came down, you know, that would be a monument that would be buried under this water, but then there would be the monument on the other side to witness that they have crossed over, all right? Mm-hmm. And that's the same thing with us in terms of, okay, you know, this is what baptism is all about. Well, you got to go down in the water. That's the place of death. You die to yourself, and then you rise with Christ, becoming a new creature in Christ, all right? And then this was a milestone in your, you know, in your journey to the promised land, this transition. When we're reading about the Jordan turned back, that's what it's talking about, how this was a powerful, powerful miracle. Then he says this, the mountains skipped like rams, the hills like the lambs. Now, what does that mean? What is it referring to? Matter of fact, let me read a little further down. It says, what ails you, O sea, that you flee, O Jordan, that you turn back, O mountains that you skip like rams, O hills like lambs. Now, if you look at this verse 4, the mountains skip like rams, the hills like lambs, and then that verse 6, O mountains that you skip like rams, O hills like lambs. Now, what's it referring to?
Could it be referring to end times?
Yes, you can make that application, but it's going back in history, all right? But it's also going to have a future fulfillment. But you go back, and what happened at Mount Sinai? I think it's pretty significant, because it said this in Exodus chapter 19. It says this, and Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they stood at the front of the mountain. Now, this is Mount Horeb or Mount Sinai, right? God, you know, because Moses told, or basically God told Moses, tell the people be ready. In 3 days, I'm going to come down and meet them. Mm-hmm. It goes on to say, now Mount Sinai was all in smoke because the Lord descended upon it in fire, and its smoke ascended like the smoke of a furnace, and the whole mountain quaked violently. All right, the whole mountain's on fire, and the whole thing is just shaking. And when the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him with thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And now, and it goes on to say this, that's when God gave the Ten Commandments, and everybody could hear God verbally give the Ten Commandments. He just didn't have them written on stone. Yeah. You know, he first gave them to them verbally. But his voice was so thunderous, and everything is shaking. The whole mountain's on fire, and undoubtedly an angel's blowing this trumpet, and it's getting louder and louder, and people are just terrified. I mean, people are just backing up and backing up and backing up, you know, because God, when God would speak, and he gave the Ten Commandments, he went through the whole thing, what you shall not do. And then it says this, and all the people perceived the thunder and the lightning flashes and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking. And when the people saw it, they trembled and stood at the distance. They were backing up, right? And they said to Moses, speak to us yourselves, and we will listen, but let not God speak to us, or we will die. Moses said to the people, do not be afraid, for God has come in order to test you, etc., etc. Now, here's the thing. when we read in Deuteronomy, we read about this coming prophet. I mean, these people were absolutely terrified when God would speak, all right? And God was doing that for a purpose. In other words, you know, people might think, well, God was just being a big bully there, trying to terrify these people. But no, fear of the Lord is beginning of wisdom. And the people told Moses, man, we don't want to hear God again, or we're going to die. I mean, that must have been quite a thing to experience, right? Well, then in Deuteronomy chapter 18, this is what it says. As a matter of fact, I'm going to read, I won't read the whole chapter, but I'm going to read the distinction here that God is making when it comes to listening to Him and then getting involved with all these other things where people are listening to demons. Because it says in Deuteronomy chapter 18, when you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, you shall not learn to imitate the detestable things of those nations. There shall not be found among you anyone who makes his son or his daughter pass through the fire. In other words, offering up their son or their child through child sacrifice. Or one who uses divination. What's divination?
Telling the future.
Yes, yes, fortune tellers. One who uses divination, one who practices witchcraft, or one who interprets omens, or a sorcerer, or one who casts a spell, or a medium, or a spiritist, or one who calls up the dead. For whoever does these things is detestable to the Lord, and because of these detestable things, your Lord your God will drive them out before you. You shall be blameless before the Lord your God. And he goes on to say this. For those nations which you shall dispossess, listen to those who practice witchcraft and the diviners, but as for you, the Lord your God has not allowed you to do so. Now listen, the Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me, meaning what?
Like Moses.
Like Moses, from among you, meaning from the Jewish nation.
Mm-hmm.
I'll read it again. The Lord your God will raise up for you a prophet like me from among you, from your countrymen, you shall listen to him. This is according to all that you asked of the Lord your God in Horeb on the day of the assembly, saying, let me not hear again the voice of the Lord my God. Let me not see this great fire anymore, or I will die. And it says this, the Lord said to me, they have spoken well. He says, now listen to what God says. I will raise up a prophet from among their countrymen. He's going to be a Jew, like you, Moses. In other words, Moses was a man mighty in word and deed, right? And I will put my words in his mouth, and he shall speak to them all that I command him. It shall come about that whoever will not listen to my words which he shall speak in my name, I myself will require it of him. Meaning what?
Judgment?
Yes, if we do not listen to the voice of Jesus Christ, then we're going to have to, you know, fall under God's judgments. And he says, but a prophet who speaks a word presumptuously in my name, which I have not commanded him to speak, or which he speaks in the name of another god, that prophet shall die. Now, we're no longer under this as far as the death penalty is concerned, but, you know, this is our tutor, this is our teacher, saying that when people were to be put to death for certain immoral or criminal acts, what God was really trying to teach them is that, you know what, this points to the second death. So we're no longer under this. I mean, if a person is practicing witch or whatever, you know, then they're not to be put to death. That was our tutor. But if they don't change their ways, they're going to experience the second death, which is the lake of fire. And he says this, that prophet shall die. And he says this, you may say in your heart, how will we know which the Lord has not spoken? When a prophet speaks in the name of the Lord, if the thing does not come about or come to true, that thing which the Lord has not spoken, the prophet has spoken presumptuously, you shall not be afraid of him. Now, I know I'm kind of all over the map here, but I'm telling you, you know, when we're talking about, you know, this prophet, and we're talking about false prophets, and we're talking about the mountain quaking and everybody being terrified, all right? And then they said, oh, man, you go speak to God because we're going to die. And God said, well, you know what? They've spoken well. And this is what I'll do for them. Rather than seeing a whole mountain on fire and just quaking and this piercing trumpet and then this thunderous voice, I'm going to send them a little babe. I sent him a little babe, a little helpless babe. I'm going to send him a babe. A child will be born to us. A son will be given to us. His name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, Prince of Peace. He's coming as a babe. Yeah. Now, you don't have to be terrified of a little babe, do you? Mm-hmm. But I tell you what, God's saying this. You don't listen to that babe? You don't listen to that man? Exactly. I'm going to require it of you.
Yeah.
See, that's what it's backing up to, right? But then, also, in a future date, it says, the mountains skip like rams, or hills like lambs, tremble over the earth before the Lord, before the God of Jacob. Now, not only was the earth trembling when God came down on Mount Sinai, but it's going to happen in a future date. When?
In tribulation period, when the earth totters back and forth like a drunkard.
Yes, when Christ returns in great power, great glory, this whole world is going to experience the biggest earthquake imaginable. Everything on earth is going to be shaken. Everything's coming down. I don't care whether it was the pyramids of Egypt, whether it's the Golden Gate Bridge, whether it's the Eiffel Tower, just name it. Every superstructure that man has built is coming down.
Mount of Olives, when his feet hit the Mount of Olives?
No, the earthquake is going to be caused, in my opinion, because of the sun. The sun is going to go out. It's going to cave in on itself, and our earth is spinning on its axis at 1,000 miles an hour. It's hurling through space, and its orbital path around the sun is 67,000 miles an hour, and it's not dead weight. So when our sun collapses and it becomes as black as sackcloth, it's going to affect the gravitational pull of the earth. And the earth, I'll read it for you. Here it says, "Behold, the Lord lays waste the earth." This is Isaiah chapter 24. "He devastates it, distorts its surface, and scatters its inhabitants." And it goes on to say this. It says, "The earth is broken asunder. The earth is split through. The earth is shaken violently. The earth reels to and fro like a drunkard, and it totters like a shack, for its transgression is heavy upon it. And it will fall and never rise again. So it will happen in that day that the Lord will punish the host of heaven on high and the kings on the earth." Yeah. Now it says, on that day he's going to punish the host of heaven on high, meaning what?
The demons?
When Christ returns, he's going to deal with all these demonic forces and all the kings of the earth that are at war with him. Yeah. And he says, "And they will be gathered together like prisoners in a dungeon, and they will be confined to a prison. After many days, they will be punished. Then the moon will be abashed, and the sun will be ashamed, for the Lord of hosts will reign on Mount Zion and in Jerusalem, and his glory will be before his elders." And also in Isaiah chapter 13, it talks about this, the Lord's return and this trembling. It says, "Wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come as a destruction from the Almighty. All hands will fall limp. Every man's heart will melt. They will be terrified. Pains and anguish will take a hold of them, and they will ride like a woman in labor, and they will look at one another in astonishment. Their faces aflame, more than likely from nuclear war. Behold, the day of the Lord is coming, cruel with fury and burning anger, to make the land a desolation, and he will exterminate its sinners from it." Now, we're all sinners, so what kind of sinners are you talking about?
Unrepentant
sinners. He goes on to say that, "For the stars of heaven and their constellations will not flash forth their light. The sun will be dark when it rises, and the moon will not shed its light. Thus I will punish the world for its evil and the wicked for their iniquity. I will also put an end to the arrogance of the proud and abase the haughtiness of the ruthless. I will make mortal man scarcer than pure gold, and mankind than the gold of Ophir. Therefore I will make the heavens tremble, and the earth will be shaken from its place at the fury of the Lord of hosts in the day of his burning anger." That's pretty heavy, don't you think? Mm-hmm. But that's what he's talking about. He's talking about this global earthquake. But I tell you what, we are told about that in Revelation chapter 6. When John says this, "I looked and he broke the sixth seal, and there was a great earthquake, and the sun became black as sackcloth made of hair, and the whole moon became like blood." In other words, this earthquake is triggered by the sun. And he says that the whole moon becomes like blood. Well, I would just venture to say this, is that it's probably going to be like our blood moons, but it's going to be blood red, all right? And it's going to be a full moon, and I would venture to say it's going to be the result of an exploded sun and all the debris and everything. But not only that, I think that from the fires on earth, it's going to reflect this moon is becoming like blood. And it says this, goes on to say this, "Then the kings of the earth and the great men and the commanders and the rich and the strong and every slave and free man hid themselves in the caves and among the rocks of the mountains. And they said to the mountains and to the rocks, fall upon us and hide us from the presence of him who sits upon the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who is able to stand?" This is what we're talking about when this future shaking of the world, where everything is going to be shaken and everything is going to be coming down. That's what all these prophets have predicted. So when you were reading this Psalm 114, yes, we can reach back in past history and see what it's referring to, but also there's coming a day when it's going to be fulfilled in the future. And what are we told also in Isaiah chapter 2? What are people going to be doing when they see Jesus Christ coming in great power and great glory and they're not right with him?
It's rocks fall on
them. Yes, I just read it there in Isaiah in Revelation chapter 6. The people hide themselves in the mountains and the caves and the cliffs, and they're saying, fall upon us and hide us from the face of him who sits upon the throne. I mean, you really got to be terrified. You really got to be white with shock. You really got to be having a major anxiety attack if you're praying for a mountain to fall upon you and crush you. And when they see Jesus Christ coming in great power and great glory, when they're not right for God with God. But it says this in Isaiah chapter 2, enter the rock and hide in the dust from the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. The proud man, look of man will be abased, and the loftiness of man will be humbled, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day. For the Lord of hosts will have a day of reckoning against everyone who is proud and lofty, against everyone who is lifted up that he may be abased, and it will be against all the political leaders in, throughout the world. And then he goes on to say this, the pride of man will be humbled, and the loftiness of man will be abased, and the Lord alone will be exalted in that day, but the idols will completely vanish. Now listen to this, men will go into the caves of the rocks, and into the holes of the ground before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to make the earth tremble. And that day men will cast away to the moles and to the bats their idols of silver and their idols of gold, which they have made for themselves to worship, in order to go into the caverns of the rocks and the clefts of the cliffs before the terror of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty when he rises to make the earth tremble. You know, this is what he's talking about. God made the earth tremble over there on Mount Sinai, and it's going to happen in the future. All right, last verse of this Psalm 114, it says this, who turned the rock into a pool of water, the flint into a fountain of water. What's he talking about there?
When Moses spoke to the rock, the water to come to
it. Yes, when the people came out of Israel, came out of Egypt, all right, one of the first things they encountered was when they ran out of water and they were murmuring and griping and complaining, they didn't have any water and they felt like God was just going to kill them, so God said, okay, I'll tell you what. He says, go over to that rock over there. And what kind of rock was it?
Flint.
It was a flint rock. I mean, you're not going to get any water out of a flint rock, believe me. But what does that rock represent?
Christ the rock.
Yes, because it says in Corinthians chapter 10, he says this, I do not want you to be unaware, brethren, that our fathers were all under the cloud and all passed through the sea, and all were baptized into Moses in the cloud and in the sea. And all were ate the same spiritual food, and notice this, and all drank the same spiritual drink, for they were drinking from a spiritual rock which followed them, and the rock was Christ. So when God told Moses, okay, tell you what to do, get the elders and get the congregation together, go over to that rock. And God said, I will stand on that rock. That's a flint rock, but that rock represents Jesus Christ. And he says, go strike that rock with your staff. So he goes over there and strikes the rock with the staff, and then out flows all this water. Right, but then about 40 years later, the people are murmuring, griping, complaining because they've been marking time out there in the desert for 40 years because of their rebellion, and they're out of water now. And so God says to Moses, okay, I tell you what, go over there and speak to that rock, and it will yield its water. All right, and that's when Moses was so ticked off at the people. Him and Aaron went over there, and he says, okay, you rebels, listen up. You want us to bring water out of this rock? Watch this. And he takes his staff and goes, bam. Bam, hits that rock. God is gracious. He lets the water flow. But then he told Moses, hey, you're not going to enter the promised land now. You didn't obey me. You didn't do what I told you, right? You dishonored me here. And people say, I don't believe it, that God would be so mean and cruel. That I remember one time I was witnessing to a biker at a store I was working at, and he was very indignant. Uh-huh. And as he's walking out the door, he's almost yelling at me. Everyone is always just witnessing. He said, are you going to tell me this God, look what he did to Moses. Just one little slip of the tongue and he can't go into the promised land. He goes, stomp it out. And now here's a guy who doesn't know what he's talking about. All right. It wasn't a slip of the tongue. And God knew that it wasn't a slip of the tongue. But the object lesson that God was trying to bring forth in this situation was this. The rock represents Christ. The first time they struck the rock. Christ only needed to be smitten once. He only needs to be struck once. He only needs to die once, and then he will yield its living water. And because he died, now all we have to do is speak to the rock. All we have to do is appeal to the rock, and it will yield its living water. But Moses blew it. See? That's what he was talking about when he's talking about verse 8, who turned the rock into a pool of water and flint into a fountain of water. All right? Okay, let's quickly go through this Psalm 115, then we're going to close for the night. And I won't take as much time commenting upon it, but we got to move ahead. It says here in this verse 1 of Psalm 115, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to you, your name, give glory because of your loving kindness, because of your truth. Now, who can tell me what that means in a nutshell?
Well,
It's not because we're faithful, it's because he's faithful.
Yes. In other words, people can't ever approach God and say, well, you know, God, I'm such a great person, you know, I deserve to come into your kingdom, or any nonsense like that. But there's a lot of people like that today, isn't there?
Yeah.
So like, well, I'm basically good. I don't need Jesus Christ to get to heaven. Hey, wait a minute. You know, it's saying here, not to us, O Lord, not to us, but to your name give glory because of your loving kindness, because of your truth. If it wasn't for God's loving kindness, nobody, you know, would stand in his presence. And then verse 2, it says, why should the nations say, where now is their God? But our God is in the heavens. He does whatever he pleases. Their idols are silver or gold, the work of a man's hands. They have mouths, but they cannot speak. They have eyes, but they cannot see. They have ears, but they cannot hear. They have noses, but they cannot smell. They have hands, but they cannot feel. They have feet, but they cannot walk. They cannot make a sound with their throat. Those who make them will become like them, everyone who trusts in them. O Israel, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. O house of Aaron, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. You who fear the Lord, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. The Lord has been mindful of us. He will bless us. He will bless the house of Israel. He will bless the house of Aaron. He will bless those who fear the Lord, the small together with the great. May the Lord give you increase, and you and your children. May you be blessed of the Lord, maker of heaven and earth. The heavens are the heavens of the Lord, but the earth he has given to the sons of men. The dead do not praise the Lord, nor do any who go down into silence. But as for us, we will bless the Lord from this time forth and forever. Praise the Lord. Now, this chapter can be kind of summed up in terms of the vast difference between the God of heaven and when it comes to people's idols. This is what God says in Isaiah chapter 40 in regards to the foolishness of men when it comes to idol and idols and idol worship. And by the way, when men begin to worship idols, we are told in Deuteronomy chapter 32, and we're also told by Paul in Corinthians, when people worship idols, what are they really worshiping?
Demons.
Demons. As a matter of fact, this is what it says in Deuteronomy chapter 32. It talks about idols or what you're really doing when you get into idol worship. It says in Deuteronomy chapter 32, verse 15. But Jeshurun is a term of endearment pointing to Israel. So when it says, but Jeshurun, our Israel, grew fat and kicked. You are grown fat, thick, and sleek. Then he forsook God who made him and scorned the rock of his salvation. They made him jealous with strange gods, with abominations. They provoked him to anger. They sacrificed to demons who were not God, to gods whom they had not known, new gods who came lately, whom your fathers did not dread. You neglected the rock who begot you and forgot the God who gave you birth. Now, and then it goes on to say, the Lord saw this and he spurned them because of the provocation of his sons and his daughters. Now, here's the thing. We're told very clearly when people get into idol worship, they're really worshiping demons. And Paul tells us that in Corinthians, that this is what people really end up doing. And interesting thing, it talks about Israel here when it says, when Israel grew fat and kicked, you have grown fat, thick, and sleek. In other words, this is what happens. God told them very clearly in Deuteronomy chapter 6, God said this, when you get into that land I'm giving you, in that land where you don't have to, where you're given everything in terms of your land and your vineyards and your homes and your wells and all your crops and everything that you're given. He says, when you eat and are satisfied, he said what? Beware, because when your bellies are full, now you're going to forget me. And the only antidote that we have when it comes to, you know, being prosperous and not forgetting God is what?
Thankfulness.
No, he says in Deuteronomy chapter. You guys been all these years. It says this. Then it shall come. These words which I am commanding you today shall be on your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your sons, and shall talk to them when you sit in your house, and when you walk by the way, and when you lie down, and when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontals on your forehead. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Then it will come about when the Lord your God brings you into the land which he swore to your fathers Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to give you, great and splendid cities which you did not build, and houses full of all good things which you did not fill, and you cisterns which you did not dig, and vineyards and olive trees which you did not plant, and you eat and are satisfied, then watch yourselves, or beware that you don't forget the Lord your God who brought you up in the land of Egypt. This is our major malfunction as this country.
Yeah.
We have become fat, we've become sleek, and God's saying this, you know what? When you're prosperous and your bellies are full, you're in a danger, very dangerous place spiritually because you're going to forget me. Your prosperity is just going to make you flat out forget me. Unless you read my word, study my word, meditate upon my word, talk about me when you rise up, when you're walking along the way, when you're having a meal, you need to teach your children about me, and when you go back, go to bed at night, otherwise you're going to forget me, right? So that's what happened when he's talking about when Israel became fat and sleek, and they forgot the God that begot them. But this is what it says in Isaiah chapter 40. All the nations are as nothing before him. They are regarded by him as less than nothing and meaningless. To whom then will you liken God? Or what likeness will you compare with him? As for the idol, a craftsman casts it. A goldsmith plates it with gold, and a silversmith fashions chains of silver. He who is too impoverished for such an offering selects a tree that does not rot. He seeks out for himself skillful craftsmen to prepare an idol that will not totter. Do you not know? Have you not heard? Has it not been declared to you from the beginning? Have you not understood from the foundation of the earth? It is he who sits above the circle of the earth, and its inhabitants are like grasshoppers, who stretch out the heavens like a curtain and spreads them out like a tent to dwell in. And then it goes on to say, it is he who reduces rulers to nothing and makes the judges of the earth meaningless. And then it goes on to say this in regards to, you know, this God of heaven compared to idols. It says, lift up your eyes on high and see who has created these stars, the one who leads forth their hosts by number. He calls them all by name because of the greatness of his might and the strength of his power. Not one of them is missing. Just look out there in the universe. It is so vast. Our cosmos is just so immense that we can't wrap our mind around it. I mean, there's probably 100 billion stars in our galaxy. There's trillions, trillions and trillions of stars in our universe. And it says that God has named them all. Given a name to every one of them. I mean, this is the God we're talking about. We're not talking about any idol worship here, right? And he goes on to say this, do you not know, have you not heard, the everlasting God, the Lord, the creator of the ends of the earth, does not become weary or tired. His understanding is inscrutable. He gives strength to the weary, and to him who lacks might, he increases power. Though youth grow weary and tired, and vigorous young men stumble badly, yet those who wait upon the Lord will gain new strength. They will mount up with wings like eagles. They will run and not get tired. They will walk and not become weary. You know, we got to look to God, not to these stinking idols that can neither breathe or whatever. It says this in Isaiah chapter 44. It says this, those who fashion a graven image are all of them futile, and their precious things are of no profit. Even their own witnesses fail to see or know, so that they will be put to shame. Who has fashioned a god or cast an idol to no profit? Behold, all his companions will be put to shame, for the craftsmen themselves are mere men. Let them all assemble themselves, let them stand up, and let them tremble, and let them come together to be put to shame. A man shapes iron into cutting tool and does his work over the coals and fashioning it with a hammer and working it with his strong arm. He also gets hungry and his strength fails and he drinks no water and becomes weary. Another shapes wood. He extends a measuring line. He outlines it with a red chalk. He works it with panels and outlines it with a compass and makes it like the form of a man, like the beauty of man, so that it may sit in a house. Surely he cuts cedars for himself and takes a cypress or an oak and raises it for himself among the trees of the forest. And he paints a fir, and the rain makes it grow. Then it becomes something for a man to burn, and he takes one of them and warms himself. He also makes a fire to bake bread. He also makes a god and worships it. He makes a graven image and falls down before it. Half of it he burns in a fire. Over this half he eats meat as he roasts a roast and is satisfied. He also warms himself and says, aha, I am warm. I have seen the fire. But the rest he makes into a god, his graven image. He falls down before it and worships it. He also prays to it and says, deliver me, for you are my God. They do not know, nor do they understand, for he has smeared. Now, I want to read this. Anybody sleeping, I want you to give me an answer to this. They do not know, nor do they understand, for he has smeared over their eyes so they cannot see, and their hearts so they cannot comprehend. No one calls, nor is there knowledge of understanding to say, I have burned half of it in a fire. I now also have baked bread over its coals. I roast meat and eat it. Then I make the rest of it into an abomination. I fall down before a block of wood. He feeds on ashes. A deceived heart, and has turned him aside, he cannot deliver himself, nor say, is there not a lie in my right hand? Now, here's the thing. He's talking about these people who make idols, right? Whether it's made out of metal or whether it's made out of wood, God says these people are absolutely senseless. But it says God has smeared manure over their eyes so that they can't see, right? So you would ask, well then how can God blame them? Who can give me an intelligent answer to that? I'm going to read that verse 18, Isaiah 44. They do not know, nor do they understand, for he has smeared over their eyes so that they cannot see, and their hearts so they cannot comprehend.
Well, that's a result of them choosing foolishness.
Well,
that's not the cause, that's the effect.
Okay, here's what I think is very significant, is when Isaiah... He first was commissioned by God. He was catapulted in the very presence of God. And he's standing there and he says he sees God high and lifted up and the train of his robe is filling the temple and they got all kinds of seraphim all over and angels all over the place. And they're all saying, holy, 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 Lord God of hosts. What's the first thing that comes out of Isaiah's mouth?
Woe is me.
He says, woe is me, for I am undone, for I am a man of unclean lips and I dwell among a people of unclean lips. And he finds himself in the presence of a holy God. And the first thing he says, man, I gotta get out of here because I'm a sinner. Yeah. Right? Yeah. But a seraphim flies over to the altar. And that altar represents, you know, the altar that they had in the Old Testament where they did all their animal sacrifices. That pointed to the cross of Christ. Right. That angel flies over to that altar in heaven, grabs a burning coal, flies over to Isaiah, touches his lips with it, and now he becomes clean. Mm-hmm. Now, why did he touch the lips? Why did he touch the mind, the eyes, the ears, the hands?
Because as a man...
That's the overflow of the heart.
Yeah.
Yes, and we're told in James that the tongue... is the very world of iniquity, and is set on fire by hell itself, and that if a man can control his tongue, he becomes a perfect man. But here's the thing. Now Isaiah is cleansed, and then God says, who shall I send?
Send me.
And he says, here I am, Lord, send me. And this is what God said to him. Then I heard a voice from the Lord saying, whom shall I send, and whom shall I go for us? Then I said, here I am, send me. And he said, God said, go and tell his people, keep on listening but do not perceive, keep on looking but do not understand. Render the hearts of this people insensitive, their ears dull, their eyes dim, otherwise they might see with their eyes, hear with their ears, and understand with their hearts, and return and be healed. Then I said, how long, O Lord? And he says, well, till all these cities are destroyed. He said, go, tell these people. He says, keep on listening, but do not perceive. Keep on looking, but do not understand. Render the hearts of these people insensitive. Their ears dull and their eyes dim. Otherwise, they might see with their eyes. Now, Jesus Christ quoted this. He quoted it in the Gospels when he was speaking of people, all right, whose hearts were hardened. Now, here's the thing. You've got to understand that if a person is determined that come hell or high water, they are going to get to know God, and they're going to follow God, and they're going to obey God. Guess what? Now they can see.
Yeah.
Right? But if they have no intention of obeying God, then this is what happens to them.
Yeah.
See, the same thing with the idol maker, the craftsman who forms an idol. God smears his eyes over so that he cannot see the truth or the lie he's engaged in. And why? Because God can see clearly. You have no intention of wanting the truth. Why? Because Jesus put his finger right on it. Men prefer darkness rather than light because their deeds are evil. That's why God will smear over their eyes. That's why men get into this idol worship. And here's the thing that I think people have to understand very clearly when it comes to idol worship is that we may say to ourselves, well, you know, that's just the Old Testament. That's ridiculous. Men don't do that today. But I beg to differ. Remember the situation with Daniel the prophet, and that you had Belshazzar, who was the king of Babylon at that particular time. And Belshazzar was throwing this big, huge, drunken feast, this orgy. And then this stupid, drunken king, you know, decides, you know what? Why don't we bring in all the utensils from the temple that they had confiscated, all right, when they overran the temple because of the God's people's wickedness? So they had them in storage. But this king, it wasn't like he was short on plates and cups. He just wanted to go out of his way to blaspheme the God of heaven.
Yeah.
So he was entertaining 1,000 of his nobles and all his concubines and all their wives and all this stuff. And they're all having a whooping it up. And then they're drinking out of these sacred vessels. And then a hand comes out and writes on the wall, "Mene, mene, tekel, upharsin." And now everything becomes deadly quiet. And this king, his face becomes pale. His knees are knocking. He's absolutely terrified. He can't find anybody to interpret this until he gets Daniel in the picture. But when they were drinking out of these holy vessels, it says they drank the wine and praised the gods of gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. Suddenly the fingers of a man's hand emerged and began writing opposite the lampstand. Now what were they worshiping? They were worshiping gold. The gods, the idols of what? Gold and silver and bronze and iron and wood and stone. That's when Daniel come in and said, "Man, you should have known better than do this, man." He says, "Now you had it, right?" And people say, "Well, that's the Old Testament, man. Get out of there. We don't do that today." I beg to differ. What's going to happen during the tribulation period when God sends judgment after judgment after judgment after judgment on this world and men do not repent? It says this, the rest of mankind, this is actually Revelation chapter 9, yeah, verse 20. It says, the rest of mankind who were not killed by these plagues did not repent of the works of their hands so as not to worship demons. Yeah. And the idols of gold and silver and brass and of stone and of wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. Now that's future date, right? What's changed? Nothing's changed, right? So when we're talking about idols here, man, we kind of understand what God is talking about here, and what's really behind it. What's the powers behind what's happening? These are demonic forces, right? That we don't wrestle against flesh and blood, but all these spiritual forces of wickedness. So when you read a Psalm 115, it's basically dealing with the what? It's dealing with idol worship. Yeah. And whatever we set up in our heart that we put before God, I don't care if it's a stinking piggy bank, that becomes our idol. But just a concluding thought, it's making this contrast all through this Psalm 115, where it says that... it says, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. O house of Aaron, trust in the Lord. You priests, trust in the Lord, not just the people. He is their help and their shield. It says, you who fear the Lord, trust in the Lord. He is their help and their shield. The Lord is mindful of us. He will bless us. In other words, the Lord is only going to become what? Our shield and our help on the condition that we trust in Him and not in our resources or our piggy bank or our portfolio or our idols or anything else. That, I live by this Proverbs 3:5-6. Trust in the Lord with all your heart. Don't rely upon your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge Him, and He will direct your path. And it's very easy to slip into idol worship and not even know it, because we can set up idols in our heart.
Yeah.